failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies. Hello, my friends. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. Our guest today will be our regular Drug Truth Network reporter, Phil Smith, who usually does the corrupt cop stories, but this time he's going to give us a full report on his recent trip to Afghanistan. We'll also hear from Glenn Greenway, who moves to Century of Lies with his Poppygate report, and we'll also hear from the Prince of Pot out of Canada, Mr. Mark Emery, to give us an update on the goings-on up in the northern latitudes. Okay, our regular listeners know our next guest. He's one of our reporters. He also works for StopTheDrugWar.org and for DRCNet. But he's not just a desk jockey. He goes out and reports from the field, and he's just returned from Afghanistan, and we want to get his report on what went on there. Hello, Phil.
Hey, Dean. How you doing?
I'm real good, sir. I'm glad you made it back safe and sound. Give us a quick summary of your trip.
Well, I went there. The hook for me going there was to attend a conference by a European drug policy think tank called the Senless Council. The Senless Council had proposed a novel solution to Afghanistan's opium production problem, and that was to license part of the crop and divert it from the black market into the legitimate international medicinal market. And they had done a feasibility study for some months, produced a 700-page volume feasibility study that they introduced at their symposium a couple of weeks ago. Of course, the United Nations, the U.S., the Western powers, and the Afghan government immediately rejected this proposal and the feasibility study, though how they managed to actually read the 700 pages and know what they were rejecting by the time they rejected it remains something of a mystery. At any rate, I was in Afghanistan for the conference. It lasted 3 days, but I stayed an extra 10 days to talk to various people. I went out in the field. I went out in eastern Nangarhar province, which is kind of a hairy place. When I went there, I had a driver and translator who had an AK-47 under the front seat. Fortunately, there was no occasion for us to have to pull it out from under the front seat. But that was Taliban country, and it was a little hairy. I went and talked to some opium farmers there, or more precisely, some former opium farmers. They had been growing poppies for the last several years, but last year the government came and tore them all out. So the farmers were a bit disgruntled since they had zero profit for their harvest last year. They also said that the government had promised them assistance, but it had never arrived. So the village elders, the village where I was, basically told me that the government are big liars. So they are unhappy. It was interesting. At first, when I first started talking to these farmers, I asked them why they weren't growing opium, and they said it was because the government had asked them not to. But as the conversation continued, they became a little bit more forthcoming, and it became clear that they had not stopped growing opium out of a sense of civic duty, but came and chopped down their crops and left them penniless for the year.
Well, Phil, this is very reminiscent of the supposed changing of the commodities down in Colombia to take away the drug war itself, and yet these people in Afghanistan also do not have roads to get to markets. They, in fact, have no market for much other than opium, do they?
It's a brutal situation there, Dean. I've traveled a lot in Latin America, and I thought I had seen third world poverty and lack of infrastructure, and then I got to Afghanistan. When I went, I mentioned going to Nangarhar province. Well, the road from Kabul to Jalalabad, the big city there, is also the international highway that takes you from Afghanistan into Pakistan. It's a dirt road. It was paved 35 years ago, before they had 3 decades of civil war and Soviet invasion and more civil war and U.S. invasion and more war. And that's one of the good roads. The best road in the country goes from Kabul to Kandahar, but no one wants to go on that road because that's Taliban country down there. Getting crops to market is a severe problem throughout the country. You got to understand, this is a very rugged country. Two-thirds of it are above 5,000 feet. Only 10% of it is actually arable agricultural land. When you come flying into Afghanistan, it looks like a giant mud ball. They have huge mountains with no trees on them. There are miles and miles of deserts. As I said, very little arable agricultural territory. The infrastructure is just terrible. In the capital city itself, Kabul, a city of 3 million people, they can't keep the lights on. Electricity was out probably 50% of the time, the entire time I was there.
Well, Phil, we've invested billions of dollars, supposedly, in rebuilding their infrastructure and bringing them towards the 20th century. Where is that money going?
That's a good question, Dean. The West has poured about $60 billion into Afghanistan since we invaded in the fall of 2001. And I talked to NGO people. I talked to people at the U.S. Embassy. I've talked to people in the Afghan government, and no one really knows. As I said, the infrastructure isn't there. The roads haven't been built. They haven't fixed the electricity in Kabul. To tell you the truth, I am mystified about just what has gone on in the last three and a half years there and where the money has gone. Now, the Afghans are starting to complain that the Western NGOs and the Western governments are sucking up a whole lot of that money, just preserving themselves so they can, you know, ride around in their SUVs in the streets of Kabul. That may be somewhat exaggerated. To be honest, I really don't know, and no one I talked to there was able to give me a good answer about why things had failed to happen in the past 3.5 years. It's something that I think this country, we need to have some congressional hearing about this. What is going on? This is sort of our forgotten war. And it's not getting better. In fact, it's getting worse. We've seen the number of U.S. troops killed there increase every year. In fact, increase rather dramatically this year. In the previous years, there were 40 or 50 killed each year. This year, it's up to 90 already. And there are among about 1,400 people who have been killed in political violence this year in Afghanistan. So the Taliban may be a spent force politically, but it seems clear that they are not a spent force militarily. They can still bring on the pain. And presumably a big part of that is because they are raking in lots of dollars from the illicit opium trade, just like everyone else in Afghanistan.
Well, how prevalent is the trade? How knowledgeable are the people of the trade?
Well, the opium trade is roughly half of the Afghan economy. This is an incredibly large figure. It depends on who you talk to. Some people say 40% of gross domestic product. Some people say 60%. In either case, it is huge. It's an order of magnitude, several orders of magnitude larger than, say, Colombia or Mexico, where in Colombia, the size of the drug trade may constitute 5% of the GDP. So we're talking about 10 times that in Afghanistan. It is the mainstay of the national economy. Everyone is involved in it. The country has a population of approximately 25 million. Probably 10% of the population is directly involved in earning a livelihood from opium. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of peasant farming families, along with hundreds of thousands of laborers. It's a very labor-intensive crop compared to some other agricultural commodities. So that means it's providing jobs in the countryside where there aren't very many other jobs.
Phil, I'm aware that there is a worldwide shortage of opiate medicines, and yet Afghanistan and the black market are producing sufficiently more than is needed, and yet it's unable to make its way to the people that are in pain.
Well, there is an argument about just what kind of shortfall there is in the global medicinal market. The international organization that's in charge of this is the International Narcotics Control Board. They claim that we're doing just fine with opiate pain medications. Thank you. We have enough and we don't need any more. Now, the Semmelweis Council, as part of its feasibility study, really crunched the numbers that the INCB provided, and they came up with dramatically different conclusions, that there is, in fact, a huge shortfall of opioid pain medications and that it is felt most severely in poor and developing countries like Afghanistan, where people if these medications are available, people can't afford to buy them. So it does appear that there actually is a global shortage of these pain medications. It also appears that the institution in charge of keeping an eye on this is systematically downplaying the shortage. And this is a battle that's going to have to take place at the level of these UN organizations and the International Narcotics Control Board if Afghanistan is to ever have a chance of joining that small select group of countries that produces opium for the legal medicinal market.
Well, Phil, it's good that that there were no instances of violence within your realm, but what's the consensus? Do people still feel that it's a ongoing battle?
There's definitely a war still on. No, there weren't any incidents while I was out in the countryside, but while I was in Kabul, they had a suicide bomber attack an Afghan army base and kill 12 soldiers. There were also rockets shot into the city, though they were not very accurate and ended up out in the boondocks on the edge of town and didn't hurt anything or anybody. But definitely there is conflict still going on in the country, especially in the south and east of the country, which is Pashtun territory where the Taliban was strongest and still maintains a presence. There are about 15,000 U.S. troops in the country, an additional 10,000 NATO forces. They're called the ISOF, the International Security Assistance Force. And they are increasingly complaining that that what they fear is not the Taliban, but the drug traffickers. The West is very concerned about trying to eradicate the opium, and there is big pressure on the ISOF, on the Security Assistance Forces, to take a greater role in combating the drug traffic. The soldiers I talk to are extremely not interested in doing that, and they are worried that they're going to end up getting shot at if they try to do that. So it's not just a Taliban conflict going on. There is conflict over the opium crop. The traffickers will shoot to defend their crops and their contraband. And there's continuing political unrest. They just had elections there about 3 weeks ago. They don't have the results yet, in part because the infrastructure is so bad. Some of the ballots are still coming in on donkeys and camels and things like that. But the political situation is very unsettled. Some of the old warlords look like they're going to end up as powerful political players in parliament, including people who are connected to the drug trade. It's sort of mind-boggling, Dean. No one knows what to do. I don't know what to do. If you try to attack opium in Afghanistan, you run the risk of totally destroying the national economy and creating political instability and most probably political violence, as farmers would run back to the tender embrace of the Taliban against the people who were trying to wipe out their ability to earn a livelihood. The United States has got $750 million invested this year in trying to eradicate the crop. Interestingly, we could probably buy the whole crop for $600 million. Go figure. It looks like a real mess. The Senlis Council proposal was an attempt at a partial answer to this. Of course, it's been rejected out of hand, but I don't see anyone else coming up with anything that looks like it has a better chance of going anywhere or of solving the opium problem and the development problems of Afghanistan. It is a real tough nut to crack.
When we opened this, we talked about the fact that you regularly bring us the corrupt cop stories. Let's talk a bit about your organization.
I write something called the Drug War Chronicle. It's for the Drug Reform Coordination Network. It's a nonprofit based in Washington, D.C. We are a frankly anti-prohibitionist drug reform organization. We're not dilly-dallying or talking about decriminalization of pot smoking. We want to legalize it all. We're quite forthright about that, basically because while we recognize the dangers that can arise from drug abuse and the harms, we also see much greater harms and damage arising from drug prohibition, and we think there has to be a better way. Frankly, we get sick to our souls when we think of all of the people in prison in the United States alone simply for drug possession. Or, poor guys from the inner city who are buck-slinging a few crack rocks, and they end up getting decades in prison. I mean, that just, that pains our souls, and we think it is fundamentally wrong. And we work on various fronts to try to ameliorate some of the damage that is done by drug prohibition.
Well, it's a worthy goal, and you've been doing this for quite some time. Are we making progress?
Well, I've been writing the Chronicle for 5 years. I was more optimistic early on at the beginning of the Bush administration. You may recall during the campaign there were a few hints that President Bush may not prosecute the drug war to the extent that his predecessors had, but those hints all evaporated into the air once he became president. The federal government remains the primary bulwark of drug prohibition. So if you're looking at the federal level, I would say that it is hard to see signs of progress. I mean, we could see, you know, we got a vote on medical marijuana in the Congress. Of course, that failed, but at least we got a vote. I mean, there is tiny, tiny progress at the federal level against a very recalcitrant federal anti-drug bureaucracy. But when you look at the states, I see a little bit more room for hope. Wherever voters have had a chance to vote on medical marijuana, they pass it. We're also starting to see even state legislatures pass it. We've seen sentencing reforms in the states. Unlike Washington, D.C., where it appears that money grows on trees, the states really have to deal with their budgets. And I've talked to state legislators in places like Texas who will tell me, you know, they are no bleeding heart liberals, and they would like to lock these guys up forever, but gosh darn it, we just can't afford it. So you're getting that kind of pragmatic response from state legislators, which is helping to reduce some of the pain associated with drug prohibition. What we're not talking about legalizing drugs or legalizing marijuana. I should stop and say there is one sign of progress, and I want to give special kudos to Roger Goodman and the King County Bar Association up in Seattle, Washington, where they have put together a really impressive proposal about moving beyond the drug war, and they actually have people in the state Senate or the state legislature there looking at these proposals that would effectively end prohibition. So while I could say there's some progress in the states, and I could also say that I'm disappointed in the lack of greater progress in the states, there are things starting to come up at the edges. I think it's clear that the consensus around drug policy is shattered now, and people are starting to look for other solutions. People like the King County Bar Association have some very good solutions if people will look at them in other places, and if they can get the legislature in Washington State to begin moving down that path, I think we may actually see the first real cracks. It would be about time.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
The largest heroin seizure in U.S. history occurred in 1991 when a half ton of China White was discovered in a San Francisco warehouse. Incredibly, U.S.-occupied Afghanistan now needs only half a day to produce the record-setting amount seized in the San Francisco case. During the last 2 years, Afghanistan has consistently produced over a ton of heroin per day, or an entire year's supply for North American black markets every 2 weeks. Afghanistan's Minister of Tribal and Frontier Affairs tells South Korea's Seoul Times that the government has become so full of drug smugglers that cabinet meetings have become a farce. CBS News reports that a U.S. counter-narcotics official estimates that 90% of Afghan police are either directly or indirectly involved in the narcotics trade. There are about 100 prisoners incarcerated in Afghanistan for drug crimes. For each one, at least 5,000 U.S. prisoners are currently serving sentences for similar offenses. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
Hi, I'm Mark Emery, the publisher of Cannabis Culture Magazine, and according to the DEA, the number one drug trafficking organization kingpin in all of Canada.
Mark, it seems there's always some news of atrocity going on in this drug war, and a Mr. Steve Tuck up there has encountered the wrath of the Americans. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, Steve Tuck came up here about 4 years ago. He's served in the Army. He injured his back parachuting while in the Army, and he has terrible pain, a variety of awful ailments. And so he came up here because he had a outdoor grow in Humboldt County, and they were busting him for it, and he just took off to here. And now his bigger concern is not so much prosecution in Humboldt County, since it wasn't federalized, but fleeing the country, or fleeing the justice of the United States government. And so it's sort of been, was deported by Canadian officials who took him right out of the hospital, took him off all his machines that were keeping him propped up, and drove him right to the border, handed him over to some U.S. officials, and then they just put him in jail, where I believe he is now either on his way to Northern California or is still in SeaTac prison down in the holding place in Seattle. And Steve was just sort of swept up and exhausted all his options, and so they just let him. You know, it just shows you how serious they are. If they want to get rid of you, you know, like, so I hope Steve, Cubby, and Renee aren't going to be next in that. But, you know, there's also a lot of great news, though. Steve Tucker is a tragic and terrible situation that I hope he's going to improve from. But, you know, with Loretta Knoll running for governor of Alabama, and even weed man Ed Fortian running in New Jersey, getting good publicity there, but certainly Loretta's outstanding response from the people of Alabama so far bodes a real change in what Americans are looking for in the political system. And even I, in my notoriety, have become more popular than ever before in Canada, and that people stop me on every block to, you know, emphasize their concern. And a lot of these people are people that don't smoke pot, so this is accomplishing a very useful thing, my getting this attempted extradition by the DEA to take me to a United States federal prison for a sentence, of course, you know, longer than what I'd get in Canada for multiple murder, which is 25 years maximum. You know, the DEA wants me to spend 30 to 35 years, or let's face it, the rest of my life behind bars for doing something no one in Canada's ever gone to jail for. But there's a lot of optimism. The mayor of Vancouver recently held a harm reduction forum, which was incredibly progressive, and he also said this crystal meth hysteria that's going around is just garbage. You know, methamphetamine is hardly any more used or popular than it was years ago, and it's just a way to ratchet up more penalties and to ignore the poor who are addicted and things like that. So, you know, we've got a lot of sanity going on around us as well. You know, I happen to be in a privileged part of the world where, you know, progressive ideas are common and spoken of frequently and held in official corridors and what have you. I really admire Loretta Knoll for managing to get Alabamians to favor progressive drug law reform in the environment she's in. That shows tremendous accomplishment to me.
I just spoke with Loretta a moment ago. She tells me that another online TV poll this time showed her leading Roy Moore by a margin of 3-1.
Well, I'm hoping that she does well in local polls. I'm really looking forward to her walking across the state. I think that'll be tremendous to galvanize her supporters, her campaign workers, and the petition drive. And I think it will keep the momentum of her campaign, which has got a real great first week and a half of publicity in all the news media. You know, she's doing a lot of radio shows. And shows that if one person's really determined, you can, within 3 years of her being an activist, she can impact quite a bit and get the issue out there, not so much get elected, although I'm optimistic that she's going to put forward a year's worth of solid campaigning, but to get people talking about prison reform, drug law reform, political reform, valuable discussion pieces we need in the years running up to the 2008 presidential election and next year's midterm elections, where I'm hoping the Democratic Party sees the House of Representatives and start reversing this terrible direction we've been moving in America.
Dr. Tom O'Connell sometimes grates on the nerves of public officials or even of some drug reformers.
Hi, I'm Tom O'Connell, MD. I'm a physician in California who for the last 4 years has been limiting his practice to interviewing applicants for cannabis recommendations under the provisions of the initiative passed in 1996.
Dr. O'Connell, the news around America talks about pain doctors being busted for too many pills. There's an instance in Canada where a gentleman was dragged across the border with a catheter still inserted. There doesn't seem to be any logic to this process of drug war. What's your thoughts on it, sir?
Well, I disagree. I think it's very logical when one goes back to the origins of the drug war, which historically was the Harrison Tax Act of 1914. And the logic, that it was a very deceptive act, but the logic that was expressed in the Supreme Court cases, which quickly converted it from a tax act to de facto prohibition, was that prescription of certain medicines was far too important to be left to doctors and could be left instead to minions of the federal government. So in other words, the first overt action taken under that law was to replace the judgment of physicians with the judgment of what are now federal prosecutors. And these are really just simple professional disagreements about the management of pain and the management of other symptoms. And the best way to understand the drug war is that, you know, it's the result of the federal government having been able to impose its will on medicine for almost 100 years, period. And the prosecutions of pain doctors around the country is just an amazing replay of the prosecutions which turned Harrison into drug prohibition.
And that applies across the board to any of these so-called controlled substances?
What I've learned from dope smokers, pot smokers, is that most drug use begins in adolescence, number one. And number two, it's a search for relief of symptoms. But it's been a distortion of that process as it goes on in adolescence by the government, which enables the drug war. The other thing that enables the drug war is the denial of most elements in society that this is a big lie. It's an easily refutable lie. The most amazing thing to me is that scientists themselves are very loath to take on the drug war. And that's what enables this pernicious doctrine to survive. My ability to state that conviction was recently solidified by discovering a book by Chris Mooney about lies that the Republicans are telling about science. And all one has to do is realize that all of these complaints exempt the drug war. They give the drug war a pass. It's not included in any of the lies that are being told about science or by the GOP. Why? Because it's a bipartisan error. And everybody's protecting ONDCP's lies by omission. That's something to think about. Anybody who's interested in that will be able to read about this in my blog in the next couple of days. www.drtom.org.
All right, that's about it, my friends. Please be sure to join us on next week's Century of Lies. I'll be providing you a report from the Hartford Drug Conference. Once again, I state there is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, moral clarity, medical data. In fact, no reason whatsoever for the drug war to continue for another second. I urge you to please do your part. Contact your officials. Bring this drug war to an end. Please visit our new website, endprohibition.org. Prohibido istak Ivalesco. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Guthrie.